Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are on paper 42, section 7, which is old single column, page 477. Lots of sevens there. All right, so we, in the previous section, we did the smaller scale aspects of the actual individuations. Remember how we were talking about the waves in the force charge, and then we got into the actual individuations, into the actual matter, itself, founded upon automatons, building up to a system of 100 automatons, which is the foundation for the electronic level, the foundation for what we currently recognize in science, and not just electrons, but protons, neutrinos, photons, etc. And then they were teasing us towards the full atomic structure that they're going to give us a handful of suggestions, hints about again tonight. It's always fascinating to to try to see if you can see in the midst of the limitations of the Revelation Mandate, what it is that they're trying to point to, especially if you do recognize some aspects or the basics of what they're saying, relative to a current viewpoint in physics. It's like, well, okay, so why did they say that? Now, what are they getting at? All right, so we're in that same mode again. We don't have anything quite as confusing as we saw towards the end of the previous section. And recall, it's long been so confusing that there's even been those who have changed the wording in that next to the last paragraph in the previous section, trying to somehow make sense of it. So let's just get into it here, and you want to think a little bit more in, starting with the basic, what's called the Bohr model of the atom, that model of the atom that they started with at the beginning of the 20th century, which they evolved away from as they went through the 20th century, into, the current concept, which is a little less solar system-like, a little less directly billiard ball like, in its conception. But nonetheless, they still are holding on to some of the basic aspects of that sort of mode of thinking, that you've got some kind of little object, quote unquote little billiard ball. It might have some very curious properties in order to get things to match up with observation. But as you start reading this, you see it's like, it looks like whoever wrote this is really going back to that, much more supposedly primitive idea of things being, more directly, especially the electrons, being much more directly in little definitive orbits around a nucleus. Is this just outdated physics? We've already touched upon this a little bit. The revelators are trying to get us to understand that there are definitive objects, and you'll see as we get into this section, there are reasons why, in a number of modes of observation, it doesn't appear as definitively solar system-like as initially thought. But definitely, you see, literally, as we start out reading here, they're going to invoke the solar system picture. So let's get into that and see what it is they want us to appreciate about where the truth was in that early 20th century, the very beginning of the 20th century concept of the atom. Go ahead.
Section 7, Atomic Matter. The formation of all matter is on the order of the solar system. There is at the center of every minute universe of energy a relatively stable, comparatively stationary, nuclear portion of material existence. This central unit is endowed with a threefold possibility of manifestation. Surrounding this energy center, there whirl in endless profusion, but in fluctuating circuits, the energy units which are faintly comparable to the planets encircling the sun of some starry group like your own solar system.
Okay. Starts out, saying on the order of the solar system, but by the time they're ending, they're saying things like faintly comparable. Okay, so, it's immediately clear they don't want you to literally go back to, a simple planetary-like atomic structure. But they are putting it forward nonetheless, so what's the point? What are they trying to get us to appreciate? Notice that in that last sentence there, surrounding this energy center, their whirl. Okay? Just the very fact that they use that word whirl, for those in the know, if you've begun to get an understanding of all the various things that are said about astronomy and physics in the Revelation, we talk about the whirl and the force charge. That's the precursor to a spiral galaxy. To invoke that word is to remind you that the space that's in between these sun and planet-like objects in this atomic structure is not empty. Firstly, it's pervaded by the force charge. And then as we saw before we got into the individuality, you can have waves in that force charge. So that domain is going to be filled with all kinds of activity. It's not going to be a vacuum. It's not going to be an emptiness. And as we saw in the previous section, these electrons and the central unit, quote-unquote, as they call it here, are made out of ultimatons. One of the properties of the ultimatons is they're coupled to the force charge. So there's all this motion going on, so you're definitely going to set up disturbances in the force charge, in the space, within the sphere of the atom. And when we saw towards the end of the previous section, they definitely were pointing us to the idea of the thinking of an atom as having a definite radius. That there is a distinct domain that's quite all coupled together. And then there's an outside of that domain. Okay, so there is going to be this domain that's going to be a whirl. Right? In that sense, that it's all in some complex way a whirl, in that second sentence, when they say there is at the center of every minute universe. See, notice how they brought in the word universe. literally means one turning. See, in the whirl. So they want you to think about it in some way that's not completely understandable to us yet, that it is all one turning. It's a coupled system. You know, there may be varying degrees of tightness to that coupling, but it's appropriate to think of it as a little minute one turning, a little minute universe. Okay, and then, you know, in the same way that when you're thinking about the simple billiard ball solar system like atom, you know, you're thinking about this stationary nucleus, you know, with little electron billiard balls going around and around. And so, I mean, in that picture, the electrons certainly are more motion-like than that nucleus. And you notice, see, they're you know, giving you words like that. There is at the center of every minute universe of energy a relatively stable, comparatively stationary nuclear portion of material existence. Okay. So there's still some truth to that differential, that even though the electron itself is a system of motion and the nucleus is a system of motion, you have the additional aspect that the electrons are in motion relative to the nucleus. Right? So, you know, in that sense, the nucleus is relatively stable. You know, it's not in orbit about something. And, you know, and comparatively stationary. Okay, so, you know, see, you can see how they're saying things in a way that you can almost take as just a validation of that old model. But what they're trying to do is say, you know, think about how there is a truth to that old model. Even if it isn't factually valid, you know, literally, the very fact that you considered it seriously for any length of time, you know, it seemed to have some usefulness, means there must be some measure of truth to it. It's like the old Ptolemaic solar system model, you know, where you had the Earth at the center and the Sun and the Moon and all the planets going around the Earth. Okay, it isn't factually the case that the Earth is at the center of the solar system and everything's going around it. But there is an element of that that's valid. There are orbits. So, you know, that's why there was, you could get some answers without too much, you know, complication out of that old model, putting the Earth at the center. I mean, it had a thread of truth to it. There are orbits. Okay. So they're doing the same thing here. They're encouraging you to go back to the beginning of the 20th century and kind of step away from thinking simplistically and literally and try to sense the truth of what was going on there. And instead of taking the detour that we took, you know, through the latter two-thirds of the 20th century, take a different track. Okay, now, one other little thing there. Surrounding this energy center, their whirl in endless profusion, but in fluctuating circuits. Okay, so it's not like in Havona, where, you know, a whirl on the sixth circuit, say, in Havona, doesn't decide one Havona day to be in the third, you know, Havona circuit. There's no fluctuating going on, right? They're eternally fixed, okay? So they don't want, you know, they want to make sure that you recognize that don't, you know, turn the atom into some existential, eternal, little miniaturized central universe, okay? Where electrons have to, you know, have to stay in some eternal mode, okay? You know, and I mean, if they didn't say that, you would have a lot of immediate difficulty of rationalizing our experiences with atoms, because we certainly seem to understand that electrons are, you know, in their relationship to the nucleus are variable. They can be in excited states, and then they can de-excite and give off a photon, and, you know, these, you know, their relationship to the nucleus can fluctuate. So, but it obviously might be, this fluctuating might be a bit complex. It's not going to be, you know, just like picturing planets, you know, changing their orbits, because there's all this between the object energy, all of these waves and the force charge and everything, all this sub-electronic activity that is going to be involved in dances and changes of the dance. Okay. But you can imagine, you know, what an endless profusion this whirl, quote-unquote, is. You know, if you go all the way to element number 100 and you have 100 electrons all generating waves in the force charge, and I mean, you know, what a profusion. You know, it's going to be just incredibly complicated, all this stuff interacting. You know, because one can generate a wave and that wave can go and, you know, impinge upon another one. So it's not, you know, they can quote unquote talk to each other. See, there's going to be some interaction between them. Okay, so all that, you know, is just basically the idea with a little bit of tweaking, you know, of the Bohr model of the atom. But then they throw in one thing that doesn't seem to have any place in some old-fashioned perspective, right in the middle there. This central unit is endowed with a threefold possibility of manifestation. Okay, I mean, if you make this the quote-unquote central unit a collection of billiard balls, a collection of protons and neutrons, it's like, well, that's kind of twofold, I guess you could say, but threefold. What is, you know, what does that mean? Okay, that's a key statement in the revelation. That, along with, and they'll point to it here in three paragraphs down. Remember, there's another key element about the basic nature of matter outside of the central universe that they tell you. You know, we've touched upon it several times. That comment that it's quote-unquote dual in construct. Now, rather than triune like it is in the central universe. There's these two fundamental statements they make. That whatever theory you know, come up with to more directly express the nature of the nucleus, the first aspects that should jump out at you in this theory is there should be a dualness to it that's very upfront, and a threefoldness that's very upfront. Okay. Obviously, the threefoldness is coming from the three-dimensionality of the absonite, you know, which projects down to a three-dimensionality of the finite. But when you're talking about the fundamental nature of that nucleus, you know, it's going to have 3 degrees of freedom in some way, you know, a threefold possibility, quote unquote, because of the three-dimensionality of the absonite, that, you know, that it is a phenomenon in, you know, it's first and foremost an absonite system of motion in that three-dimensional absonite space. And then on top of it, it has some sort of dual construct. Okay, and so, you know, as I developed, you know, what I've done in coming up with a more fundamental physics, you know, the interesting thing was, you know, I started doing that before I found the Urantia book. You know, and I had developed a system that had a twofoldness and a threefoldness in it. It has a twofold set of threes. It has, you know, two sets of three in it, coupled, you know, a pair of threes. You know, and then when I started studying the Urantia book, you know, sure enough, you see these two fundamental statements, like, ah, you know, so no wonder I seem to be having some success in rationalizing all of the fundamental phenomena with this system I had been developing. It certainly is capturing very directly what they're saying you need to have, a dual and a threefold. You're trying to understand the system of motions. The system of motions that is a proton, say. It's going to be some number of units of motion that are going to have a symmetry to them. There's going to be a twofold and a threefold symmetry. So think about it just simply. If I had six locations where I could put a number, you know, one of those six locations could have the number one in it. That would be one unit of motion. That location could have a two in it. That would be two units of motion. Okay. If I have two sets of three, okay, see, I've got a twofold and a threefold. Okay, and I don't want to go into any complication, but see, just that basic idea that putting units of motion into this system. Two sets of three. Right.
What's a twofold?
It's two sets. That's dual. Okay. Of three. That's the threefold. Okay. You know, it's not six numbers, so it's not a sixfold symmetry. It's two sets of three. You know, so it's threefold and it's dual. You know, and then the way it works in a coupled fashion like this. You know, if you recall, the other thing that you have in play is when they first tell you it's dual, in contrast to the central universe, it's triune, they say, but out here in dual expression land, you also have the positive and negative aspect of, you know, what we call charge. And so in other words, what they're telling you is in the central universe, it's not dual, it's triune. So, I mean, you probably have three sets of three. That would be your first guess. But when you project that, you know, remember that's in an absonite domain. When you project that into the finite, you can have two sets of three that fit into the finite, and then the two working together, which is sort of a hint of that third, you know, which is fully independent in the central universe. But here it's, you know, it's sort of super additive of the dual, you know, so it's the pair working together. So it's a quasi third fact.
So can you name one of them?
Yeah, I mean, this is the system.
I can understand what you're talking about.
I mean, so, you know, the question is, can you figure out a system for, you know, what is an electron and what's a proton and et cetera? And I mean, and we don't want to go into this. I mean, it's too complicated. We don't want to get into the science, okay? We'll spend 2 hours on just that, because it's complex, okay? But just tell you, you know, remember, see, they said that quasi third thing is the charge. In these two sets of three numbers, the third number are coupled together. They're the same. So like if they're both one, you know, if the third number in both of them is, you know, is a one, then you've got a charge of one. If the third number in both of them is a two, you have a charge of two. See, that's what charge is. It's that particular motion, and it's the motion of the two coupled together.
Is that the manifestation, so to speak?
Right, so that motion manifests as a phenomenon we call charge. It's threefold, but a measure of that of the third, you know, degree of freedom is taken up in this coupled fashion to do the charge, whereas the first two locations in the two are independent to take on units of motion that basically are giving you the mass-like aspect of the structure. Okay, okay, so...
So but, not all three are coupled. Only the third position.
Only the third position are coupled like that, yes. So, I mean, see, I had developed this, you know, recognizing if I had a couple simple rules, I could generate all possible symbols, and the number of symbols exactly matches all of the particles, including all the nuclei. See, so with one system, you know, and a couple of simple rules, you know, and I didn't have any idea of why these rules needed to be, well, but the more I read the Revelation, the more I can see how they were suggesting rules like this. And so that's what you discover. If you lay out all particles, including all nuclei, and you lay out all symbols, there's a one-to-one correspondence. There's no extra symbols, there's no extra particles. You've figured out what the basic system of motion is for all these things. You have the quote-unquote grand unified theory, at least the beginnings of it.
So the central unit is referring to the nucleus?
Yes, that's the nucleus. Right. The central unit, quote-unquote, is the nucleus. Yes. And in this first paragraph, like I said, it could be talking literally about a collection of protons and neutrons in the nucleus. You know, there's nothing there that seems to be demanding that it not be that billiard ball model nucleus. Okay. However, the next paragraph changes that. Okay. And remember, I pointed out that that at the end of the previous section, they were already hinting towards this pretty definitively. But now we're going to get it point blank about how we're supposed to think about this nucleus. Okay. Yep.
Is it possible that on this mention of threefold possibility of manifestation, that we could get some kind of clue from the section before where it says the automatons have three varieties of motions?
No, that's a different three. Okay, but it's a good point. It's I've mentioned this before. It's good to mention it again. There's lots of threes and there's lots of sevens. You can't equate every three. You can't equate every seven. The threefoldness that you saw with the automatons was. There's an aspect of the automaton itself, and then there's the relationship of between automatons within the sphere of the particle, and then there's a relationship of the automatons to what's outside of the particle. Okay, so there's an inside and an outside, and then just the existential fact. That's the threefoldness there. See, so it's not like XYZ. It's not like the three-dimensionality of the absentate. It's a different threefoldness. I mean, you don't think of, in the finite, you don't think of the x-axis, y-axis, z-axis as one of them is inside and one of them is outside and one of them just is. No, that's not the kind of threefold pattern there. It's a different three.
Is it also correct to assume that the physical creatures in a super universe are also dual and threefold?
Right, so all of, I mean, not just the material creatures like us or physical creatures like us, you know, or material sons and daughters, etc., but the physical energy that's part of the body of a divine counselor, say, that physical energy that's in their body has a threefold and a twofoldness to it. Everything does. Marantia substance is predicated on this twofoldness, threefoldness. Everything of a physical expression outside of the central universe is fundamentally threefold and dual. That's why if you're a Melchizedek and you have this ability to vary the manifestation of your body's energy system, You know, you can turn some knob, as it were, inside of yourself and manifest your body so that it's like mine, as a material body. Well, you know, when it's manifesting like my body as a material body, obviously it's threefold and dual. It had to be threefold and dual before as well, right? I mean, he's not somehow magically changing, you know, the physics. You know, he's just altering its manifestation, right? You know, same way with a with a secondary midware. They're threefold and dual, but they can turn a knob and now photons interact with him, and then they turn it again, and now the photons don't interact with him. So, you know, now you see me, now you don't, right? But, you know, it's still the basic threefold dual energy system. You know, it just has a different relationship with the electronic level.
How do you do that?
Right. So, you know, if we knew how they did that, we would know some seriously fundamental physics.
I could lose 20
minutes. Right. That is, you know, the question that you want to ask a secondary midware. Okay. In what way are you near me? You know, in energy system. If you knew that, you know, you would have, you know, an amazing understanding of, you know, of the nature of reality. Now, they probably couldn't explain it, but, you know, but if they could give you some hint, you know, just to know, you know, what is that knob you're turning? Okay, it's none of the knobs that any of us can think of it, because those are all, you know, knobs at right angles to this knob. I mean, you know, has nothing to do with changing the electronic, you know, energy system. It's something orthogonal to those sorts of changes. Okay. Let's see. Did we? Oh, yeah. You asked me a question, right? So we're still ready for the next paragraph. Yeah. Okay.
Within the atom of the electrons revolve about the central proton. With about the same comparative room the planets have as they revolve about the sun in the space of the solar system, there is the same relative distance in comparison with actual size between the atomic nucleus and the inner electronic circuit as exists between the inner planet, Mercury, and your sun.
Okay, so it's definitely some more solar system, but let's start at the beginning. So within the atom, okay, just the way it, you know, that opening phrase, you know, it seemed to be saying pretty directly there's some sort of surface, there's some sort of boundary, there's an inside and an outside, okay, and it's not just, you know, arbitrary, you know, like where you put the boundary of the state of Colorado or something like that. It's something, you know, very innate. There's a within and a without. So within the atom, the electrons revolve about the central proton. Okay? You're going, oh, so they're talking about the hydrogen atom. No, look at the sentence. Okay? Within the atom, the electrons. Okay? It doesn't say, you know, within the hydrogen atom, the electron revolves about the central proton. It does not say that. Okay? Okay, so why, you know, it's like, well, so do they not know what the word proton means? Who wrote this?
Why didn't they change?
You know, it's like, do they not know what exactly you're supposed to be thinking about here? I mean, you know, this just seems totally confusing. You know, they're telling me about these solar systems, and everyone knows that the hydrogen atom is, you know, the solar system has one planet, you know, and a central sun of a proton. I mean, it's the same thing. It's like, do they, you know, you're reading along and you see the word energy, and they're like, well, okay, that's not really the proper definition of energy. Do they not know what the definition of the word energy is? They need to broaden the use of words. But they have to use any words that we have if it's at all possible. So rather than coining a new term, they're going to use a term we already have. They're just going to use it a little bit more literally. Okay, so the word proton here doesn't mean that particle that we call a proton. It means more literally what that word means, etymologically. It means the principal individuation, right? The root word is protos, first, okay? It's the principal individuation. Every atom has a single particle at the center, okay? Not a collection of particles, it has one particle, a central, quote-unquote, proton, okay? And that central proton has a threefold possibility of manifestation. So the threefoldness is not in any way like we always have to try to rationalize a threefoldness by making three billiard balls. By the time we get to the latter part of the 20th century, we have a threefold possibility of manifestation theory that we had invented. It's called the quark model, quark theory. The idea that, for instance, a proton is composed of three billiard balls, three quarks. Okay, why did we invent that theory? Because when we were observing a proton, we noticed things about it. It seemed to have a threefold possibility of manifestation, it and all the other particles like it. They all seem to be playing within a threefold possibility of manifestation space. It's like, well, there's obviously a threefold possibility of manifestation. That means, the only thing that could mean is there's three billiard balls inside of all these particles. How else could it be threefold? It has to be literally three billiard balls, three quarks. No, there aren't three quarks inside of a proton. There are no quarks, okay? It's a single particle. It's a collection of 100 ultimatons with a little bit of electronic level motion added to that base. And the way you can add motion to the base has a threefold possibility. Okay? You add it like this, you get a proton. You add it like this, you get a sigma particle. You add it like this, you get a lambda particle, et cetera. You add it like this, you get a pion, right? But in all that space of all those different particles, it's a variation within a threefold possibility of manifestation. Okay, and it's not because there's three different, there's three quarks inside of that. Okay, there's three distinct billiard balls inside of that. okay, so. Now, do you go, so every time I see the word proton in the book, I'm supposed to interpret it that way? No. Sometimes they're talking about what we call a proton. You've got to figure out which it is in the context. Right? Just like it is with everything in the Revelation. They use a preposition of. It can have a number of different meanings. If you pick the incorrect, sense of that word, you're going to misinterpret the sentence. They're not going to tell you which of it is. You've got to figure that out. Which sense of the preposition of allows truth to flow through this sentence, and which doesn't. If you don't have the ability to discriminate, then not very likely you're going to pick the correct sense of the preposition of, and you're going to totally get off on a wrong tangent. That's the way the Revelation is. It requires objective consciousness, the ability to assess and discriminate like that. Right? Just like we talk about this all the time. When they say personality, do they mean the existential influence from eternity, or do they mean as a shorthand for personalized self? When they use the word energy, do they mean energy in the specific sense or the general sense? On and on. It's always like that.
Yep. So, if you've got nickel, it's supposedly, in seventh grade science, it's 28 protons and 28 electrons and 28 neutrons. And then you have.
Well, no, number, it's more neutrons than that.
Oh, it's seventh grade science.
not even in seventh grade science would they tell you that they're the same number. It starts out the same number in the smaller ones, but by the time you get to nickel, it has more neutrons than protons.
Forget about the neutrons.
Yeah, yeah. So that's 28.
There's really only one proton in there?
There's not one proton in there in the sense that there used to be 28. There's one central particle. Okay, that's not a proton or neutron, as we call things protons and neutrons.
So it may have a positive charge?
It's a single positively charged particle.
So when they differentiate between those two, they're pretty close. One theoretically, in seventh grade science, has one more electron, and as we were taught, has one more proton than the other. That's why, it's copper versus nickel, let's put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
And, on this little chart that I have here, it's pretty up to date. They say basically the same thing. What you're saying is that what the revelation is telling us, I'm talking about electrons right now, but from the proton point of view, is the proton itself may not necessarily be 27 or 28 different little billiard balls, but it is a unit of energy that has a different energy manifestation they both have a different energy.
Simplest way to begin to appreciate how this is possible, if you had, which you didn't learn in middle school or junior high, is that there are particles that they study that are similar to protons and neutrons that don't have, either one of the three options, a charge of plus one, a charge of minus one, or zero charge. They might have a charge of plus two. Okay, but no one thinks that it's two particles. Everyone knows it's one particle with a charge of plus two. Okay, that's what you have with nickel. It's one particle with a charge of plus 28. It has that many units of charge-like motion. See, but in the billiard ball model, like I said, if there's 28 units of anything, the only way you can rationalize that in the billiard ball model is you have to have 28 billiard balls. Okay? It's like, well, you already know that you have some of your billiard balls that have a charge of two that you don't rationalize as two billiard balls. Why do you rationalize that one billiard ball with a charge of two there, but in the case of nickel, you rationalize that it's 28 billiard balls? Why aren't you consistent? It's because you rationalized the atoms before you discovered those other things, and no one is logically assessing the theory anymore. It's just a hodgepodge of anachronisms.
Well, maybe this is the evolution.
Why do they think that the neutron is in the nucleus? Because it was the only particle they had to stick in there, so they stuck it in there and made it work. Why before they discovered the neutron in 1932, why didn't they have neutrons in the nucleus? Because they didn't know about it, so they stuck the protons and electrons in the nucleus and made them work.
I always wondered how come protons
if we hadn't
together if they were the same charge, didn't make any sense. Then the arrangement book talks about the mesotron. Well,
we'll get to that next section. Okay.
But I'm just trying to clarify what you said a minute ago, which is, for me, it's quite interesting. I mean, maybe today's science recognizes that. I don't know.
But no, today's science
the
doesn't.
I'm working with,
no. Today's science doesn't recognize anything like worth talking about here. Okay. No one thinks of the nucleus as a single particle. Whatever charge it needs to have. Okay, there are 28 electrons in nickel, 28 billiard balls, quote unquote. But there aren't multiple billiard balls in the nucleus. It's just a single particle. Okay, and so when you see that central proton there, telling you that there's one particle, when you go back and see this central unit in the previous one, very literally unit. Okay, not just kind of figuratively, there's one nucleus, and so it's a unit. No, there's one particle. It is literally a central unit. you know, units, one.
And it may or may not be the same size or mass in each one, right?
Right. For instance, like they in the previous section, remember I pointed that out, they mentioned positronium, where the central particle is a positive electron. It's a positron. There your central proton is a positron. Okay? You know, remember when they said, while it may be no larger than a negative electron, you know, a positive electron is no heart, right? It may be, you know, that might be the central proton, quote unquote, the central principal particle, the central positively charged particle with all these negatively charged electrons around it. Right?
That central particle has, in the case of nickel, has 28 increments of size, right?
No, it has a lot more than that. It's got all of what we currently rationalize as neutrons, too. You know, it has a mass number more than 28. It has a, you know, an atomic number of 28, but it has a mass number a lot more than that. You know, and you know, I mean, there's calcium 40, okay, which we rationalize as 20 protons and 20 neutrons, has a mass number of 40, an atomic number of 20. Okay, and so its size, you know, is how many billiard balls. You know, they think there's 40 billiard balls, so, you know, it's 40 times as big as the nucleus of a hydrogen, you know, atom. A protium form of hydrogen, you know, not deuterium or tritium. Okay. All right, so it's very important, you know, to not, to get this ingrained in you so that when we go forward, if you don't know definitively that the nucleus is a single particle, you will misinterpret things they say. Okay, you can't go, well, no, they're telling me that there's a collection of particles there. It's like, no, that if they're talking about multiple ones, they're saying, now you think about it like this right now. Right? They're referring to how you think about it now, currently, and then look for how they're saying, you think about it like this right now. Have you ever thought about this issue? You know, they're giving you where you are and then trying to encourage you to go in a direction from there. But if you just think, oh no, that the Revelation validates it. You know, there's 28 protons in a nickel nucleus. I never noticed this sentence. Okay, well, this sentence is obviously an error. So we got to change this sentence. I mean, you can't think like that. You've got to start at the top, not at the bottom. Don't start with our ignorance. Start with the revelation. And then if they're speaking about our ignorance, you know, you recognize that that's what it is, our ignorance. This is how you currently ignorantly think about it.
Is the neutron in science something that's been discovered or is it something that's been rationalized?
No, definitely. I mean, yeah, there's free neutrons. You know, you can have one going across the room here, you know, and you can, you know, watch its path, you know, descending in gravity and, you know, and following a parabolic path. I mean, it's a definite particle.
So a single
lasts for many, many minutes.
A single neutron would be a collection of 100 ultimatons.
Yep.
With no charge, but would have mass.
Right. It's a, yeah, and again, it's a particular system of motion that in the net has no, it has no net charge. And you know, and it has a net unit mass number. You know, it's a mass number of one, just like a proton is a mass number of one. Okay.
We don't all have the same background.
I know.
Business, I'll talk.
But I mean, again, remember, don't try to figure this all out now, because you know, I mean, you can keep asking me questions, and I can keep talking. But I mean, try to just get the basics first. Just let a couple things just be present with you. Don't try to understand everything quite yet. You know, they're telling you there's a single particle. It's like, well, I have all kinds of questions about that. Okay, great. Hold the questions in your mind. You know, reflect on the questions. Don't seek an immediate resolution of questions. Okay, have the courage to hold questions, and so that you know questions can build up. Questions get answered in a system, and you have to allow questions to build up until there's a wholeness of a question, and then you can start answering them. The problem that you know, why we have this gobbledygook model we have right now of the atom is because the scientists 100 years ago weren't patient like that. At the very first sign of a question, they quickly found the first thing that they could rationalize is and did it, answered that question, and then found another question and ad hoc answered it, and then see, and so you just end up with this hodgepodge of ad hoc answers to questions, all rationalized together.
But many of us have read this book several times and know what it's going to say later on, and are trying to make that fit with what you're saying right now.
I understand. Right. All right. But okay. All right. Okay. So that very key statement that even when it's electrons plural, there's a central proton. Central principle individuation. All right. Okay, and they're now, like I said, they're definitely invoking the solar system picture again. Okay, and I mean, basically, what the revelators are doing here is they're touching on the human source work that I mentioned. They use a lot in here, you know, Schwann's architecture of the universe. And the way that solar system rationalization goes is they use the Earth and the Earth's orbit. And you're looking at the comparison of the size of the Earth compared to the size of its orbit, and how that matches up pretty well with the Bohr model of the atom. And the old idea of how big an electron was. So, you know, the revelators can't use that directly. It's like, well, you know, but we can do something similar. Instead of using the Earth, let's use Mercury, and let's use Mercury's orbit, and let's not have them think about the ratio between the size of Mercury's orbit and the size of Mercury. Let's have them think about the ratio of the size of Mercury's orbit compared to the size of the Sun. See what they're saying here? You know, how they're talking about that? There's the same relative distance in comparison with actual size between the atomic nucleus and the inner electronic circuit as exists between the inner planet Mercury and your Sun. They're wanting you to think about how much in between the particles there is, you know, and they're pointing out that in a relative way, that gap between the surface of the Sun and the orbit of Mercury is giving you a sense of how big a gap there is between the radius of the nucleus, you know, the boundary of that sphere at the center of the atom, and the inner electronic circuit. Okay. Well, now if you start playing with this, it's kind of confusing. It's like, well, I don't know, I can't seem to make sense out of this. The numbers don't seem to jive with what it kind of ought to be. Well, you have to we haven't gotten to it, but they're going to immediately start pointing out that what we're really trying to do in this section is think about the full 100 electron atom, that full system, so that they can talk about all 100 circuits and how there's patterns in that 100, and there's an innermost of those 100 and an outermost of that 100. Okay, it's in that sense that it's the inner of the 100 that's the inner electronic circuit here. It's not, well, maybe let me just take hydrogen, where I have one electron, you know, and its basic orbital radius. See if that makes sense, you know, and it won't. Okay, that is the inner one, but it's also the outer one. Okay, it's the only one, with hydrogen one. The bigger the charge gets on the central proton, the closer in that inner most circuit is, you know, it's the closest in when you have all 100 in play, okay, and that's what they're pointing to here, is, you know, how tight it gets, you know, when it's as tight as it gets, in element number 100. And it still has lots of room. Okay?
That, to me, was the point. As opposed to the detail, it was more to a picture of, there's a lot of room there.
Right.
Because we can't necessarily see that.
Right. That is just the basic thing. Yeah, they want you to get the sense there's a lot of room. But the point is not to just say that. There's physics here. Okay? And you know there's physics because it says there is the same relative distance in comparison with actual size. Okay? Ooh, wouldn't it be cool if the revelation could tell us what the actual size of a nucleus is? Something that we've been trying to figure out, something we can't know right now. All we can do, we can fire electrons at a nucleus, and we can get kind of a rough averagey-like size. Remember what you're dealing with. You're dealing with the electrostatic interaction between a negative electron and a positive nucleus. You know, and there's an attraction. So if you send an electron past it, you know, it'll be bent in its path. You know, and the closer it gets, the more it's bent. You know, but that electrostatic force size is infinite. You know, in our current idea of that electrostatic force, it goes to infinity. So the sphere of influence is infinite. Okay? You know, so we can get what we call a charge radius. We can get kind of, you know, the sort of mean between zero and infinity, you know, sort of effective charge-like interaction radius. But there's no way we can get an actual radius. No one can get a nucleus out in front of them and get a calipers on it, you know, and dial the calipers until they can't, you know, turn the knob anymore, and then look at the reading on it. Okay? Wouldn't it be cool if we were given a data point, okay, an actual size? See, it's saying actual because, you know, they know we get an effective electrostatic interaction size, but we don't get an actual size. As a matter of fact, in many ways, you know, the more we went on in the 20th century, the less we thought anything had an actual size. You know, everything is just a mathematical abstraction. You know, the electron went, at the beginning of the 20th century, we thought of it having an actual size. To the end, you know, by the time we get to the end of the century, we believe that an electron has zero size.
Doesn't it give the size of the electron somewhere?
Yeah, at the end of the previous section. Yeah, right? But current science thinks it's a zero volume point. Okay. Okay. And so you can imagine how non-definite the size of anything is when you build it out of zero size objects. Okay. So that, and you know, we're not going to get into the actual mathematics of it, but if you do the mathematics with this in mind, they're giving you, as much as they can, a way of helping to pin this down so that you can get a sense of actually how big a nucleus is.
Have you done it?
Yeah, I mean, and you can, well, I mean, you have to make assumptions. As I say, I mean, it's not trivial here. I'm just trying to tell you that it's as much of a hint as they can give you. You don't get something, they don't give you exact size of every nucleus. You know, you can't get that out of here, but I mean, just you know, okay. It's a hint along that line, you know. So when you're developing the physics, you can use this as an anchor point to try to pin it down. And you can see what it's giving you first and foremost is the size of the nucleus of fermium, element 100. Okay, the biggest one. Okay, the biggest nucleus compared to the inner electronic circuit, you know, about that biggest nucleus, is like mercury compared to the size of the sun. Okay? Mercury's orbit compared to the size of the sun. All right.
That's a very profound statement.
Okay, so, all right, I mean, just, always remember that the point is not just to give a religionist, you know, a sense of how much space there is in an atom. You know, yeah, you know, the sentence can help a religionist to not have such a, you know, a completely figmentary idea of an atom. Okay, but it's here to help a physicist that's more advanced than any alive today to figure out a genuine true physics. Because until he figures out a genuine true physics, that religionist cannot have a true religion. Okay? Yeah, don't ever forget that. There is no true religion without true science. Right. So, all of us have just some quasi-religion, because none of us have a true science. You know, we don't want to forget that. You don't want to start absolutizing your quasi-religion. Okay? You have a very vague, confused idea of God and everything else related to religion. It's only faintly true. Okay? And it's like, well, but I want it to be true because I'm going to be scared if it's not. Yeah. Courageous and independent cosmic thinking. Okay? You have to have the courage to be ignorant. Yeah. Don't be so fearful that you absolutize your ignorance. Okay? Have the courage to be ignorant, to be a child of God and not the deity, you know, devoid of ignorance. Yep.
Do you envision the nucleus, which is a collection of 100 ultimatons,
mm-hmm.
of a hydrogen atom, for instance,
mm-hmm.
to be smaller than the fermium
yes.
nucleus?
Yeah, so I don't have to visualize it. It says it right here in the next to last sentence of the previous section. The smallest atom, hydrogen, you know, and you know, they're talking about smallest and largest and, yeah.
Well, but an atom, that's...
That's different than the nucleus, yes, I understand, okay. Yes. Right. But in the same way. The ultimatons do not describe orbits or whirl about in circuits within the electrons, you know, within the collection of 100, but they do spread or cluster in accordance to their axial revolutionary velocities. Right. So the nuclear particle spreads or clusters, gets larger or smaller depending on how much you've spun up the axial revolutions. You spin them all the way up to fermium and you got a great big thing. You know, you spin them all the way down to the nucleus of hydrogen 1 and you got a small thing. Spread or cluster.
Is this nucleus stable without all the electrons around it?
Yes.
So you could strip all the electrons off.
And we do.
And you still have that.
Yes. Right. We can pump the energy way up on things. You know, we can strip all the electrons off of some very large atoms, you know, and study the raw, you know, nucleus and its stability and things like that. You know, if it's, you know, how that, like if the way, one of the things that the nucleus of some large atom does is if it captures an electron, you take all the electrons away and it can't do that anymore. See, so you're going to you don't give it that opportunity anymore. Things like that, you know, we study that sort of stuff. So anyway, that was a lot to do about that, but it's not a trivial process when you start playing around with a calculator to figure out what the heck this is referring to. And it doesn't finally make sense until you get the recognition, oh, they're talking about the closest of all 100, right, compared to the nucleus of those 100. And once you do that, it's like, ah, you know, and so then you can compare that with how big we think that, you know, the charge radius is, you know. It's in the ballpark, but, you know, it's a little different. All right.
The electronic axial revolutions and their orbital velocities about the atomic nucleus are both beyond the human imagination, not to mention the velocities of their component ultimatons. The positive particles of radium fly off into space at the rate of 10,000 miles a second, while the negative particles attain a velocity approximating that of light.
Okay, so again, the last sentence, you know, if you're, you know, a basic Christian flavor religionist, say, and you know nothing about radioactive decay, and you go, whoa, I had no idea, you know, so it throws off, okay, you know, but that's nothing new. I mean, you know, you can look that up on the Wikipedia page if you want, okay? You know, the rate of 10,000 miles a second, you know, and approximating that of light. You know, see, for an alpha particle, it's about 10,000 miles a second, and for a beta particle, you know, it's almost the speed of light. Alpha decay and beta decay. So I seem to be wasting a sentence here, telling me something that everyone knows. Well, they're wasting a sentence if all you are is a fact finder. Right? You know, why are they pointing to that? They're pointing to an obvious fact that every physicist knows. Because the physicist is just focused on the facts and not the truth. Okay. What is it telling you? If you're watching this atom, and all of a sudden something, this giant, you know, bullet-like thing, this alpha particle, comes flying out of it at 5% of the speed of light. Okay? Does that tell you, wow, whatever that atom is, it's a very quiescent thing? No, it doesn't seem to be. Isn't that, you're going, well, if that thing is coming flying out at 5% the speed of light, whatever is going on inside there must be very dynamic, you know, and someone just snipped a, you know, a tether, and, you know, and the tether ball just went flying at 5% the speed of light.
It doesn't come out of quiescence.
Right? But, you know, what do we have basically for an atom now? We've got this basically static collection of billiard balls in the middle. And we don't even have electrons going around in orbits anymore fast. We have an orbital. We have a cloud of mathematical density. All sounds pretty static. Okay? You know, you don't even really have an electron cloud. It's all mathematics. You don't have any objects at all. The nucleus is just a bunch of equations, and the orbitals are just equations. There's no objectivity to it at all. It's just, you know, making the energies balance in the equations. Okay, and so see, they're pointing out. It's like, no, think about it, guys. Okay, if you were still interested in science instead of just getting correct answers, so instead of just technology, you would want a theory of an atom where whatever it is literally inside is very dynamic. Not some static, you know, abstraction that gets the correct answer. That's why they're doing that. They're trying to remind you of the obvious, you know, that's been forgotten. You know, there's no logical, you know, imposition on our theories anymore. It's like, well, okay, that theory is all fine and dandy, guys, but you know, it has, in the lowest order, it doesn't have the nature that it needs to have. How can quiescence produce the speed of light, you know? It's like, well, like this, and they give you the equations, and see all the energies balance. It's like, yeah, but it isn't logical. That's why they're doing that. You know, they're pointing out, not only do you have literally very high orbital velocities, you know, where we don't have orbits anymore, and we have orbitals, we have orbit-like abstractions, you know, that aren't very orbit-like at all. They're just a fuzzy region of probability. But then, you know, there's literal axial revolution of a high, degree. You know, not to mention, as they say, the velocities of the component ultimatons. You've got stuff that, in both a finite sense and an absolute sense, is moving. is zooming. You know, and if you poke it, you know, that zooming that's all bottled up could turn into something that's, you know, goes flying off on a tangent. As you observe, they say. All right, so that's the point of that is to remind you of a basic fact, and to get you to think about it logically, you know, and to bring in the fullness of all the way down to what's inside of a particle. You know, an electron is not a point of zero volume. It's a collection of 100 ultimatons, and all 100 of those ultimatons have axial revolutionary velocities. You know, they don't just have a mathematical abstraction that you maybe call spin or something like that. Okay? They're literal. They're objective. Okay. Okay, I got something on that?
It doesn't say specifically the velocities of the ultimatons are axial. Right?
Over here, in the previous section, axial revolutionary velocities. You know, remember when they were talking about the ultimatons in the previous section? Oh, okay. They told us it was axial. Remember, they do not describe orbits or whirl about in circuits, so they're not doing like the electrons are. Let's see, what else do we have in there? The one, you know, why do they say beyond the human imagination? It's like, you know, again, it's like, well, no, it's not beyond my imagination. I can write 299.792.458 meters per second. That's the speed of light in meters per second. Okay, why is that beyond my imagination? It's like, no, the number is not beyond your imagination, but the literalness, see, is beyond your imagination. You can't literally conceive of that kind of a speed. You know, it's just a number. Okay?
Not something that small.
I mean, you know, the simplest way to remind yourself of how you can't really wrap your mind around how fast the speed of light is, how many times would a photon go around the equator of the Earth in 1 second, if it was orbiting, you know, at the surface of the Earth going around the equator. In 1 second, how many times, you know, will the speed of light get that particle around the Earth? 7.5 times in 1 second.
That's quick.
Okay, in 1 second, you know, okay, that's how fast the speed of light is. Goes around the Earth 7.5 times in 1 second. Okay. Right. So if it's going around something that's, you know, has a radius of a few times 10 to the minus 15 meters, in 1 second, how many times does it go around that little guy?
Not a bunch. Not more than you can.
Right.
Not something you can conceive.
Right. I mean, from our perspective, it's not going around at all. It's like a loop of wire. You know, it's like a solid. Okay. Right? Okay, so how, you know, when something is going around that many times in 1 second, you know, how homogenized, how spread out is this, you know, how much is it functioning like a single entity and not, you know, Pluto lazily drifting about the sun? Okay? Right? It's going to be very hard to hit it in a way where you get, you know, you get to the nucleus in between the electrons zipping around and smacking your object you're trying to throw in there. No matter how you come at it, it's going to seem like it's a solid.
Right? The electrons aren't in our orbit.
No, the electrons are in an orbit.
They are, actually.
Right.
It's almost everywhere.
As they just said, the electronic axial revolutions and their orbital velocities.
Okay.
Both. So why is it that a lot of times when you're, you know, interacting with an atom, does it seem like the electrons are everywhere at the same time? Why does a mathematical model that literally assumes that they are literally everywhere at the same time have, work? Because there is a high degree of, effectively, they're going so fast, right, that they effectively are at all spots at the same time. They aren't literally at all spots at the same time, but there's a high degree of effectively they are. Okay. Okay. Let's see, that they're trying to get you to just remember, it doesn't have to literally be like you're assuming right now, that they literally are at all places at the same time. It could just be, a measure of truth to that, as effectively they are. This is why they're giving us these statements, to try to get you to think logically about it again. Recognize that you don't have to believe in the literalness of your current assumptions. Obviously, there's some validity to your current assumptions because it gets you the correct answer. Okay? But an object can't literally be at all places at the same time if it's an object. It's like, well, I don't assume it's an object anymore. Yes, I know, that's the problem. Okay? There's no literal objectivity to your model. It's just mathematical. Okay? Okay.
So when you say orbital, and it said there before fluctuating circuits, does the orbit always like the planets? I mean, or is the orbit kind of...
The electrons go from circuit to circuit. That's what they mean by fluctuating circuits. It's not always in the same circuit. It can be excited and be in a different higher energy circuit, and go back
so
to
it.
To
is it always like this, or can it go? I mean, whatever you were saying a minute ago is if you were trying to get past it, going like this, well, if you just went around it, you'd hit it, right? But that's not the case necessarily.
No, I mean, anyway. Again, remember that a lot of this has an absoniteness to it that projects into the finite in every way.
Okay.
But okay. Let's see here. All right, let's keep going here.
The local universes are of decimal construction. There are just 100 distinguishable atomic materializations of space energy in a dual universe. That is the maximum possible organization of matter in Nebadon. These 100 forms of matter consist of a regular series in which from 1 to 100 electrons revolve around a central and relatively compact nucleus. It is this orderly and dependable association of various energies that constitute matter.
Okay, so you see they're trying to definitively lay down that there are literal objects, electrons, they're in literal orbits. The velocities are gigantic, and the domain is small relative to our sense of things. But nonetheless, it's all very literal. We talked about this before. Don't confuse. The maximum possible organization of matter in Nebadon. It's like, well, so if I went to Avalon, it'd be different. Remember. Why did they start out the local universes are of decimal construction? Why are they speaking that way? Okay. There's two domains. There's the central universe, and then what's outside of the central universe is a collection. It's a universe of universes. It's a universe of local universes. It's a construct built out of fundamental nuggets of local universes, all of which, in terms of the physics, are identical. So pick one of the fundamental units of the universe of universes and study it, and you know what's going in every nugget. Okay. Let's see. You can see they mentioned the dual there, and they're giving you hints. It's 100, just as you might expect, because 10 times 10 is 100. 10 squared, dual 2, right? And this issue, there are just 100 distinguishable atomic materializations of space energy. It's like, well, okay, we've already proved the revelation false. we've got 118 that we've done already. Okay? All right, but again, they're trying to tell you that there's only 100 that are even possibly stable. You know? Anything bigger than element 100, bigger than fermium, has no inherent stability. Okay? It comes apart. It doesn't matter how quiet the environment is. So, you know, just see how they say that, how they, you know, there are just 100 distinguishable. It's like, well, if they didn't want me to be confused, you know, why didn't they put in something about fundamentally stable or whatnot, that, you know? I mean, there's no truth to element 101 or element 102. Those have no connection to eternity, the truths of eternity. They're a fact of time. They're not a truth of eternity. Okay? And the fact that they're not a truth of eternity is why they're not an ongoing fact of time.
We do talk about it.
We're going to read about it a little bit here in just a couple paragraphs, but that's what they're trying to get you to think about the difference. Everyone is just focused on facts. So a fact finder goes to, a Wikipedia page and sees element 118. A fact finder reads this and says 100. 100 does not equal 118, therefore the revelation is invalidated. No, it's not a revelation of facts. It's a revelation of truth. You know, what's the truth? You know, in truth there's only 100 elements. It doesn't matter if in fact, you make element 198, okay? There's no truth to that element.
You couldn't build anything out of
it. Right. That's what they're trying to get you to, by just stating it without any factual qualification. It's because the truth doesn't need to be qualified. Truth doesn't need extra words that you might want to put in there. Okay? It's a revelation of truth.
Orderly and dependable seems to be.
Right. Right, so and again, this pattern that's in physical matter, it's a very definitive pattern to everything. It doesn't just coincidentally end up being 100. It's 100 because 10 times 10 is 100, period, and there's no other option. let's see, all right. Notice how they're, stressing it again. Regular series in which from 1 to 100 electrons. And so they're really driving that home. They want you to think about the electrons as a literal object that have a radius, not the zero radius abstraction you have right now. And then when you put it into the atom, it isn't even a zero radius point. It becomes a fact that's at all locations from zero to infinity simultaneously. It has no location. Trying to drive home, you can't have pure abstractions like that and expect them to have any relationship to reality. And so when you take those abstractions and then take them literally like you currently do, over the course of the 20th century, we took those abstractions literally and then said, well, if this is literally a fact, then the truth of reality is dot, dot, dot. It's like, no, a figment doesn't imply truth. And that's why your so-called truths are so absurd, because they aren't predicated on actual facts. So-called truths like there is no causality. Causality is an illusion that builds up as you make things bigger and bigger. That fundamentally there is no causality, but if you put a lot of non-causality into a blob, it gives the illusion of being causal. That's the truth now. Okay, it's like no, I mean the reason that it appears to start out non-causal is because you're starting with a figment and not a fact. Right? You know, and so then to conclude, well, no, I'm not starting with a figment, I'm starting with a fact. Figments are facts, and since they're fundamental facts, then all fact is figment. I'm a figment. You know, it's not that God is a figment, but the universe is a figment. I'm a figment. Everything's a figment. It's all just, you know, it's all just an illusion. There's no reality at all. That's the truth that we get from current physics.
That hurts my head.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you change.
That's a quote unquote truth. See.
Thank you.
Yes. All right. The quote unquote truth. Right. Which is obviously absurdity, falsehood. You know. But if you don't have any ability to discriminate truth from falsehood, matter of fact, you don't even believe really, you know, really that the word truth has any validity.
Right. We all do have a God-given ability
to discriminate. And a free will that can reject that God-given ability to discriminate.
Ability to discriminate.
And that's that. That there's none so blind as those who will not see. You know, in this case, what we're talking about is, you know, positivism. I mean, scientists are positivists. You know, and one of the fundamental assumptions is that, you know, from a Urantia book perspective, is you have no encirclement in the Holy Spirit. You have no logical acumen. There is no such thing as logic. You know, you believe that, you know, as a doctrinal assumption, that nothing can be self-evident. That anyone who believes something is self-evident is delusional.
How does that a simpleton. Relate to the Urantia book perspective?
If you look up the principles of positivism, you won't see that you have no encirclement in the Holy Spirit. You know, that won't be the way they describe that initial assumption. Okay, you know, but they'll describe it as, you know, there is no such thing as logic. There is no such thing as causality.
He didn't say look it up in your original.
All right. Let's see. All right. Yeah, next one here.
Not every world will show 100 recognizable elements at the surface, but they are somewhere present, have been present, or in the process of evolution. Conditions surrounding the origin and subsequent evolution of a planet determine how many of the 100 atomic types will be observable. The heavier atoms are not found on the surface of many worlds. Even on Urantia, the known heavier elements manifest a tendency to fly to pieces, as is illustrated by radium behavior.
And radium behavior is, you know, the unraveling of uranium. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Does fermium fly to pieces?
Yes. Yes. Everything from 84 on, yeah.
But why do they say...
Okay, yeah, I was just going to, yeah. Okay, so notice... you know, one of the interesting things they're throwing in, not every world will show 100 recognizable elements at the surface. See, that's, you know, it's like, between the lines there, they seem to be suggesting that there may be shielding, you know, issues where what's, you know, radioactivity might vary inside compared to outside, at least in some worlds. You know, they don't give you any details, but they're certainly hinting at that. I mean, And what's the main thread of truth to that? Remember, why are things radioactive? Because the environment is... there is an environment, and that environment is interacting with the atom. If you don't believe there's an environment, or if you have some kind of environment, you don't think it has any consequence to the atom, then obviously it wouldn't matter where this atom was. It was down deep in the earth, or, you know, flying through the air, or what it was. Okay, it's just some internal thing that makes it come apart.
Right.
Okay.
That's our assumption right now.
Right, but no. Yeah, I mean, obviously there could be variations in the environment between the inside and the outside. So that's a whole, you know, interesting thing that you could explore. Let's see, what else do we have there? Right, I mean, you know, remember they, you know, it starts with single mass, you know, single mass hydrogen and goes all the way up to fermium. You know, these things build up, as we've talked about, in the cold depths of space. You know, so you could be in a region where you just haven't built anything that big yet, for instance, or you could be in a region where the environment is different than when things built up. And when you, if you look at what stable isotopes we have, there's obvious fossils where there's no way that certain stable isotopes that we find on the surface of the Earth here could have built up in this environment. They had to have built up in a different environment and got transported here. You know, those are very obvious when you look at, you know, at the isotopes. See, so this sort of stuff that they're talking about, that there's the environment. And if you would just, if you had that as an initial assumption, just studying the data you have, it's very immediately obvious, these environmental issues. Rather than just thinking, well, it just is what it is and it's magical in the first place. Let's see here. And then the other thing you make is like, why even on Urantia? You know, what's with the even, you know, qualification there? Even on Urantia, because, I mean, Urantia is not that radical an environment. You know, remember, you've read this, the paper where they talk about how radical some, you know, planetary environments are, even inhabited planetary environments. You know, we're right in the middle, basically, of everything. There's nothing radical about our environment. You know, but even in this environment, everything greater than bismuth is, you know, comes apart. You know, and even bismuth comes apart a little bit. You know, but definitely everything from 84 to 100 comes apart.
You were saying several classes ago, that, mm-hmm. you know, when a universe gets into light and life or whatever, they don't continue to come apart.
Right. At some point, they're going to clamp down on all this, and there won't be a disruptive environment. It'll be just like, you know, when you go to Gerasim, you know, or the Mansion World. So, you know, if you go to an architectural world, fermium and everything smaller are stable. You know, they build fancy things out of fermium and, you know, and uranium and whatnot. You know, plutonium, and because they're all stable there in that environment where the master physical controllers have, you know, complete grip. They are master physical controllers. They can grip things and not allow anything to happen.
So eventually the planet does evolve into a stable situation.
Fifth stage of light and life is when they start to take a hold of everything, basically start to turn it into an architectural, like, completely controlled world. You know, there's nothing natural about an architectural sphere. Every ultimaton is artificial. You know, every ultimaton is doing what a master physical controller is telling it to do. No ultimaton is doing what it wants to do. Every single ultimaton is completely controlled.
Yeah. Excuse me.
No air molecule moves, yeah, except that, you know, it is in their grip. Yeah.
I just have a question.
Yep.
What do you mean it's artificial? Because I thought the architecture world had a lot of crystal structures and stuff.
What does the word artificial mean? That's the, you know, the, how you answer that question. What's the difference between artificial and quote-unquote natural? You know, to say something is artificial, it means it's an art form. The universe is mind-made and personality-managed. The entire universe is an art form. The entire universe is actually artificial. There is no natural. There only appears to be a difference between artificial and natural because the Almighty Supreme hasn't completely manifested. The Almighty Supreme will take away all quote-unquote natural things. And there, you know, is there anything quote-unquote natural about the Isle of Paradise? No. It's pure art form. It's, you know, you know, this whole thing, you know, where we've deified natural, so-called natural, anti-artificial. That's what we mean by natural. We mean anti-artificial. We've deified anti-artificial, you know, and demonized artificial.
Well, because we think
it's the opposite.
God's artificial.
Yeah.
That's the reason that we've done that.
Right, right. You know, but again, it's when you go to an architectural world, you don't find a world where the forest is not managed because you want it to be natural, like God intended it to be. No, it's the exact opposite. You're 180 degrees false in that thought.
Again.
Every single ultimaton of all the trees on Edentia are managed. Every ultimaton is purposed. See, we're deifying the not yet purposed.
Doesn't mean they don't grow necessarily.
No, they all grow and everything.
But perfectly.
Perfectly.
Not one branch purposed. Out of place.
Not one branch out of place. Everything is.
Ooh, I don't know if I like that.
See, but I'm stressing that because
it's an artist behind it.
Right.
It's the most magnificent artist ever.
The tree of life.
He doesn't need to be. They'll all be unique. It's not going to be cookie cutter.
Right. Remember.
He's an artist.
Remember one of the things. You know, this is one of the fundamental truths that the fifth epical revelation reveals. Like I said, I mean, there isn't any idea we have that isn't 180 degrees false. I mean, when you actually recognize what the revelation is trying to say, to come to terms with, we think something that's untouched by man is beautiful. That's our definition of beautiful. No, it's like, why can't they describe what even the first mansion world is like? Because we can't even contemplate what genuine beauty is. Beauty is something so transcendent of anything we can imagine right now. Wait till you see something that's personality managed 100%. Then and only then will you experience beauty. But the truth of what I'm trying to say. I mean, I'm not saying that there is no, what we experience when we look at the Grand Canyon is absolutely ugly. Okay, it's not a dichotomy I'm preaching here. I'm just saying it's extremely relative. You know, when you start to see something that's genuinely beautiful, in contrast, what we think is beautiful will look ugly.
Pile of rocks.
Right?
Do you think when people start trying to change things from, what the resource, natural resources that we have, and they do a really poor job at it, and give it a bad name, if they're irresponsible and not really are being the best creative.
They're not creators.
Right, yeah. Again, right. Like I said, our definition of artificial, is take an ignorant person, watch what they do, and that's what artificial means. Okay. Well, how about if you don't take an ignorant person? What if you take a divine counselor or personalized deity and watch what they do? Okay. See, and just notice how, we've got all these things that are just, it's like I said, someone who doesn't believe in God, most atheists don't believe in God because they listen to some ignorant person describe the idea of God, recognize that it's silly and foolish, therefore God doesn't exist. Your question?
On the web here, does that mean that on the mansion worlds that beauty is only skin deep will have a new meaning?
this whole concept of of beauty, for instance, is we're in need of some serious reflection in these areas. It's just like, well, I don't like the patterns that personalities manifest. That's because you haven't actually seen a personality manifest a pattern. you've seen something that you falsely called personality manifest pattern, and you've, you know, improperly, you know, exalted it. You know, there's just so many things like that. I mean, if, you know, if what a person manifests doesn't seem to match what you would imagine God the Father would bestow on someone, then it's not personality that you're observing. yeah, it. I mean, obviously you have the issue of when you start to, you know, use personality negatively. But, you know, setting that aside, you know, we're not thinking about someone going iniquitous, but just a run-of-the-mill, you know, manifestation of someone in their ignorance, you know, and thinking that, you know, the way they do certain things, that's their personality. No, that's just their self. It's not their personality. That's not the, you're not seeing their, the eternal or the eternity influence manifesting. You're seeing some temporal influence manifesting. Just like I was saying, you know, you can watch element number 101, and it has a whole bunch of properties that are not that different than element 100, and you're going, I don't see the big contrast here. Element 101 seems to be doing basically the same kind of things that element 100 does, you know, and you know, why, you know, why would there be, as the Revelators are saying, this sharp boundary, you know, line? Well, it's because that element 101 isn't a downstepped expression of eternity. It's just an expression of time. Element 100 is a downstepped expression of eternity. And it's like, well, okay, in eternity there's infinity. If I downstep it, shouldn't there be an infinite number of elements? No. You downstep eternity, you get time. You downstep infinity, and you get finity. You know, a downstepped expression of infinity has got to be a finite number of elements. So, you know, just appreciating how, what it's like to bring truth into relationship with the facts of time. Just because there's not an infinite number of elements doesn't mean the elements don't embody a relationship to infinity and eternity. You got to keep in mind what, how the mastery of this downstepping process. You know, the architects of the master universe, you know how to bring this down so that infinity and eternity get bottled up in a very finite set of elements. You know, from going from 1 to 100, in some way, in truth, you span all of infinity. Okay, let's keep going. We're going to way run out of time here if we don't keep moving. Okay, so, so that's, you know, the deal is, you know, with even on Urantia, so you can have a very vanilla-like habitable world, like our, you know, our planet is, and still an awful lot of the heavier elements are, you know, are unstable. And the reason for that is that that influence that's making you unstable doesn't have any sort of very direct influence on our the integrity of our biology. They describe that up in the biology papers. All right.
Stability of the atom depends on the number of electrically inactive neutrons in the central body. Chemical behavior is wholly dependent and the activity of the freely revolving electrons.
Okay, so there it is. Inactive neutrons in the central body. It's like, okay, isn't that just invalidating? Like I said, if you don't get the central proton thing first, okay, Just in the same way they're not using the word, always using the word proton like we use it, they're not always using the word neutron like we use it. Now, every other time in the next section that they use the word neutron, they are using it in our sense, because they're talking about the way we think about the nucleus in the next section with protons and neutron billiard balls. Okay, but here, they're kind of harkening you back to before 1932, before we discovered this particle that we finally definitively called a neutron and then stuck it into the nucleus. We had been dabbling for a long time with the idea that, especially in the nucleus, there we were thinking we needed some sort of particle that didn't have a charge, that was neutral. And the term neutron was being used for that mystery long before it was the name of that particle that we, for which we now use that designation. The actual nucleus, that actual system of motions that is the nuclear particle, there is a neutron-like part of that. The part of the motion that just adds to the mass and doesn't have anything to do with that charge kind of motion. One unit of that is like a neutron. If you take all the system of motion that is the neutron particle and look at just the net, it doesn't have net any charge or even net some of its mass-like motions. It has just one unit of mass-like motion. Okay. This is what they're referring to here. The stability of an atom depends upon the number of electrically inactive quote-unquote neutrons in the central body. If you take a given element, if you take its stable isotope and you add more units of this mass-like motion, you'll make it unstable. Or if you take away units of that mass-like motion, you'll make it unstable. It has to have a certain number of those units so that the system is relatively symmetric. If you add some or take some away, it makes it asymmetric and unstable. You know, and we currently rationalize that literally. You know, instead of thinking of adding and subtracting units of motion, we literally add and subtract billiard balls. Okay? But remember how arbitrary this is. The neutron, when we finally discovered it, you know, and measured it moving across space in front of us, okay, it's not a stable particle. Okay? You know, as you're watching it go across the room, it falls apart. Okay? So to stick it in, you know, literally into the nucleus, you have to add this new rationalization scheme that when it's in a nucleus, it doesn't fall apart. Okay, well, how about if it's not in the nucleus in the first place, and then I don't have to dream up this second rationalization so it doesn't fall apart in the nucleus? Right. There is no strong force that keeps it from falling apart because it's not in the nucleus in the first place. Okay, there are units of motion that are neutron-like, but there aren't literally neutrons in the nucleus. Okay, and that's what they mean here. You know, the electrically inactive units of motion, as opposed to the electrically active units of motion, the kinds of units of motion that give that charge property of it, like 28 of them for nickel. Right?
That's the number of them depends
right.
on the number. Right?
Right, the number of them, right? The number of those, you know, like I said, you add those or subtract those. Right. If you add some, it becomes unstable. If you subtract some, it becomes unstable. Okay. You're adding and subtracting units of motion. You aren't adding and subtracting billiard balls. They are still neutral individuations. The literal meaning of neutron, just like the literal meaning of proton is.
Neutron meaning charge in this case.
Yeah, meaning charge. They're not charged. They're non-charged-like individuations of motion. They're neutrons, just like the proton is the principal individuation. You know, they're just using the words in a literal sense. You know, why did we call those abstractions that we're speculating, why do we call them neutrons initially, before we even discovered the neutron? You know, it's because we thought there was some unit of electric charge neutral phenomenon in the nucleus, and we just called it the neutral one, the neutral thing, the neutron. Okay. And then we discovered this particle that was neutral. It's like, oh, that's it. It's a billiard ball and it has no charge. That's got to be that neutron. Let's use that name now for it and stick it into the nucleus. That's what they did. Okay, but the revelators are just trying to get you to think more generally. And see, so it's, on the one hand, you have the electrons, and that's chemistry. But in the nucleus, you have these units of motion, some of which are charge-like, some of which aren't. And that's related to stability. But the two work together in a system, as they're about to point out in the next paragraph.
In Orvinton, it has never been possible naturally to assemble over 100 orbital electrons in one atomic system. When 101 have been artificially introduced into the orbital field, the result has always been the well-nigh instantaneous disruption of the central proton with the wild dispersion of the electrons and other liberated energies.
Yeah, I was just going to say, right. So one of the things that some of you may have in your book is the addition of the of well-nigh before instantaneous. That should not be there. Yeah, we'll get to that in a second. Okay, so you notice now they've, in the universe of universes, they didn't want to just, it wanted to make sure, it's like, well, how about, not just Nebadon, but what about other local universes? If you go anywhere in the super universe of Orvinton, is there some spot where element 101 is stable? No. Okay, now look at how they're describing this. It looks like they're just taking some nucleus and trying to have it have 101 electrons. When 101 have been artificially introduced into the orbital field, okay, but remember, it's a whole package. I mean, you have to have the kind of nucleus that could potentially have 101 electrons synchronized with it. And they're saying, if you try to build one of those things, the nucleus is not stable. It comes apart.
Here again, it's a central proton.
Yes, right. And this is the these are the two times where you have it directly. See, again, we're obviously talking about 101 electrons, okay, and not the central collection of billiard balls. It's a central proton. Right? There's a single particle. You're trying to make a single particle that has a charge of 101, right? Not 101 charges, but a single particle with a charge of 101, positive charge of 101. Okay, now, why did, why is that word well-nigh been added and subtracted and whatnot from it? Okay, it's not in the original. Again, the fact finders went and they looked up element 101. And they went, well, I don't know about instantaneous. I see a half-life, for element 101, some of the isotopes that's not a tiny fraction of a second. So I don't think that's instantaneous. It might be about instantaneous, sorta. So we'll throw in well-nigh, so that the fact finders are not disrupted. It's like, no, okay. I mean, first of all, the word instantaneous doesn't have to mean immediately, okay? It's not the only sense of instant. What does it mean there? The result has always been the instantaneous disruption, okay? You make element 101, and there's going to be an instant when it comes apart, okay? It doesn't have to be immediately. That isn't a requirement of the word instantaneous. It's just pointing to the coming apart isn't spread out over many instants. There's one instant in which it comes apart. It's an instantaneous disruption. Okay? And that's what we observe with these things. When they come apart, it's not like it kind of comes apart a little bit here and then a little later some more of it comes apart. No, there's an instant when it comes apart. Okay.
Why did they need to put well nigh in there?
Because they were thinking that instantaneous means immediately. It's like, you know, you can look, there's other meanings. Okay. You know, if the meaning you picked doesn't make sense, rather than changing the book, why don't you pick it, you know, another meaning? Yeah. Right? That one's happened lots of times. Lots of changes are like that.
I think it's funny they use well nigh instead of almost.
Well, they did it well nigh because they use well nigh further down. They're trying to be revelatory.
I know.
You know, it's like writing in King James English. So that, you know, God said it.
Well, not revelatory.
Okay.
Yeah. Let's put words in his mouth.
All right. So, you know, the key thing here is, and it is very definitive when you look at all the isotopes of the elements. That it's just as plain as day that the mechanism for getting the thing more symmetric so that it's stable, beta decay, as a systematic phenomenon disappears at element 100, never to reappear again. It's full on there as a systematic phenomenon in element 99. You go to element 100, it's not there, and it's not there systematically after that. I mean, it's as plain as day that they're fundamentally unstable past 100. The evidence, all the evidence that we've collected is right there for anyone to notice, but no one has really noticed because they just aren't thinking big picture like that. They're lost down in all the facts. So, you know, what you observe is there's no sign of readjustment possibility. There is going to be an instant, sooner or later, where this thing is going to come apart. You know, the time scale of all that is a function of the environment. Right. See, so, I mean, the very fact that they put well nigh in there is adopting the belief that there is no environmental influence on instability. Right. It's like, well, the revelation has told you many times there is. Yeah, but the revelation is obviously false. Science is true.
Yeah.
Okay, so we need to change. I mean, it's the same old thing, okay? Anyway, fact finders, not truth seekers.
Wouldn't they have done this in one of their artificial environments? They're quiet.
Right. Right. See, they would have done it in some very artificial environment where...
the environment's not shredding.
Right. It just, you know, it's not stable.
Yeah.
Okay, keep going here.
Well, atoms may contain from 1 to 100 orbital electrons. Only the outer 10 electrons of the larger atoms revolve about the central nucleus as distinct and discrete bodies, intactly and compactly swing around on precise and definite orbits. The 30 electrons nearest the center are difficult of observation or detection as separate and organized bodies. The same comparative ratio of electronic behavior in relation to nuclear proximity obtains in all atoms regardless of the number of electrons embraced. The nearer the nucleus, the less there is of electronic individuality. The wave-like energy extension of an electron may so spread out as to occupy the whole of the lesser atomic orbits. Especially is this true of the electrons nearest the atomic nucleus.
All right, so there, so you have that very definitive description of what you've heard me say many times. Yeah. You know, because there's not a, there is nothing inside of the, between the particles. It's pervaded by the force charge, and there's waves in that force charge. Particles are coupled to the force charge. They're just pointing that out. See, so you get, it's the electrons get effectively blurred out. All of their momentum gets spread out into a field of waves that's just as bumpy, just as oomphy, has just as much momentum, as much kick as the particle itself. And so, you begin to lose the identity of it. You can poke about anywhere and it feels solid. Because it's just, it's going around really fast, and it's, those waves in the force charge are constantly being regenerated.
It's like a million boats going around.
Right. So, again, that's the basic reason why when we assume the electron is everywhere instead of at one point along an orbit, it's because of this wave field. It's a standing wave field. It doesn't dissipate standing because it's just constantly being regenerated, right? Very, very quickly. And they're going to explain this a little bit more, but this is an interesting thing that they're bringing out, that something, again, that we don't appreciate because we don't have much at all of an objective, literal sense of the atom. That, for us, all the electrons are fuzzed out. Mm-hmm. The mathematics are all fuzzed out. They're saying, objectively, the ones close in, are effectively kind of fuzzed out. But the outer ones have a high degree of distinctiveness to them. Especially if you're talking about the big atoms and those outermost electrons. They're starting to become quite distinctly separate objects and, aren't being blurred much. It's a lot like, remember when we were talking about the sun. And the interior is pretty blurred together. But as you get out, you start to have objects that are, not so much blurred into the sphere. They're more like little billiard balls and separate. Okay, and so in telling you that you kind of have that ratio, that the inner 3/10, 30/100, are pretty smeared out, but the outer 1/10, is quite independent. So independent of how many, if you have 28, to have that kind of ratio. All right.
When you get to the smaller ones.
Yeah.
That.
Right. I mean, obviously, when you have one, say, okay, this, right, or two. Right, or two, or three, or four, or five, So, but within, they're just giving you a rough little rule of thumb. Yeah.
Have we seen that pattern?
No, that's what I'm saying. We have no way to, we don't even look for that pattern, let alone really kind of have a way to assess it very definitively. We don't deal with the actuality of the atom. We just deal with it mathematically. Right? If we could get this sort of stuff, they couldn't have told us this. Remember, the only reason they can have these sentences is because we can't figure this out ourselves. So don't be surprised if you can't find any sense of this. When you're reading a Wikipedia page or something.
The 30 innermost orbital electrons have individuality, but their energy systems tend to intermingle, extending from electron to electron and well-nigh from orbit to orbit. The next 30 electrons constitute the second family, or energy zone, and are of advancing individuality, bodies of matter exerting a more complete control over their attendant energy systems. The next 30 electrons, the third energy zone, are still more individualized and circulate in more distinct and definite orbits. The last 10 electrons present in only the 10 heaviest elements, are possessed of the dignity of independence and are therefore able to escape more or less freely from the control of the mother nucleus. With the minimum variation in temperature and pressure, the members of this fourth and outermost group of electrons will escape from the grasp of the central nucleus, as is illustrated by the spontaneous disruption of uranium and kindred elements.
Okay, so 3 points in there, maybe four. Let's start with the big point. So you notice we've broken the 100 into four subsets. Very interesting thing. We remember how we saw indirectly this fourfold before when they're talking about the average size of an atom, you know, and we got 2.5. It's like, well, 2.5 would be the average of 1, 2, 3, and 4. It seemed to be hinting at like four regimes, four domains, four families, you know, four, you know, see how they're, you know, energy zones, energy, you know, the way they're, so this is kind of an interesting element that they're adding into the physics, is to try to figure out that. And they aren't explaining it, the why of it, but they keep pointing at this. And, you know, here you see an interesting pattern. You've got the basic number 10, tenfold phenomenon, and we're getting a 10 times 3 to get 30. And we have three of those. Okay? So there's threes and tens, you know, in this pattern. So there's definitely things to figure out there, which I don't understand yet. Let's see. At the beginning there, you know, you see the well-nigh. You can see why they added the well-nigh above. Well-nigh from orbit to orbit. It says extending from electron to electron, but why doesn't it say and from orbit to orbit? Okay, no matter how much blurring there is with all these waves in the force charge, it doesn't blur orbits together. Okay, you still can have orbital transitions, excited states, you know, de-exciting. And we have that in our mathematics. We blur everything all together and we still have transitions from higher energy states to lower energy states. And so that's why it's, you know, it's well nigh. You can't blur the orbits or the atom couldn't potentially have the behavior that we observe it to have. I mean, you know, we observe innermost electrons being captured by the nucleus. You know, if there wasn't an orbit in there, that wouldn't make sense, you know. You know, and higher ones going down and filling that lowest orbit. And, you know, so, yeah, the orbits don't get blurred out, even though there's a lot of blurring. Notice that the dignity of independence. Courageous and independent cosmic thinking, the dignity. Your personality is absolutely unique. You know, when you can finally achieve that definitive independence, you're more personal. See, they're hinting at the parallel, see, between personality and pattern here. You know, and look at how they do it. Even in control of the mother nucleus. Right? Eventually, you get birthed out of the womb of the creative mother spirit, for instance, are independent of her mind. Right? Now you're blurred into her mind to a degree. You know, we're all using her mind. You know, see, so we're like these electrons, kind of blurred into a pool. We aren't as independent as we could be. But eventually we will be able to manifest personality definitively enough to be independent of the mother nucleus, the local universe, and being blurred in it mindily. You notice again there, where from a current scientific perspective, it's like, well, whoever wrote this doesn't understand science. And with a minimum of variation in temperature and pressure, the members of this fourth or outermost group of electrons will escape from the grasp of the central nucleus, as is illustrated by the spontaneous disruption of uranium and kindred elements. You know, and they're going, oh, this person thinks that the electrons cause it to, you know, uranium to fall apart. And it's like, no, remember what we were saying up above with 101. Right, I mean, you not only have those last 10 electrons, but you have the very delicate elements of the central proton that are related to those last 10. You know, and that that's fragile. You know, it can be disrupted. You know, so they speak in these ways to try to challenge you to think about it as a system more. From a billiard ball model, that's an absurdity. You know, it's like saying that if I ionize an atom, it'll fall apart. You know, it'll be radioactive or something. You know, or it will, you know, it'll unravel like radioactivity. It's like no, they're just trying to remind you of, even though those 10 have a degree of dignity, quote unquote, they're still coupled into the system. Just like with 101, you're not just adding 101st electron, you're, you know, augmenting the nucleus to attempt to synchronize with that 101st. Okay, let's get the last part here.
The first 27 atoms, those containing from 1 to 27 orbital electrons, are more easy of comprehension than the rest. From 28 upward, we encounter more and more of the unpredictability of the supposed presence of the unqualified absolute. But some of this electronic unpredictability is due to differential ultimatonic axial revolutionary velocities and to the unexplained huddling proclivity of ultimatons. Other influences, physical, electrical, magnetic, and gravitational, also operate to produce variable electronic behavior. Atoms, therefore, are similar to persons as to predictability. Statisticians may announce laws governing a large number of either atoms or persons, but not for a single individual atom or person.
See how at the end they're, you know, connecting personality and pattern, just like, you know, you could see they were doing earlier there. Just, you know, quickly here, they're obviously pointing to the complexity of the physics. That there's not only, you know, when they say the unpredictability of the supposed presence of the unqualified absolute, all the way down to the most rarefied sense, the environment is complicated. You know, the inscrutableness of God the Absolute coming into time and space from the bottom up as three absolutes, you know, in this case the unqualified, when we're talking about matter, you know, there's potential for all kinds of inscrutable things, you know, of the supreme, etc., in the environment. But then the internal nature, like they're saying after that, you know, when they say, but some of this electronic unpredictability, the internalness is very complicated too. I mean, even they don't totally understand the physics of the absonite huddling proclivity thing. You know, why ultimatons come together like we were talking about before when they were, you know, giving us the description of ultimatons coming together. You know, so all of that complexity starts to make it so that it's not as simplistically discrete and stepwise as the pattern seems to suggest in the smaller elements. You know, and we even see this. You know, we have ideas of electronic configurations, you know, in our orbital model. S orbitals, P orbitals, D orbitals, these things that you might remember from some basic physics or, you know, chemistry if you took it. And even as we try to rationalize things with, you know, with our current system, everything is going along fine for the first 27. And sure enough, if you look up element 28, you'll see that they're not quite sure how to specify the electronic configuration of nickel, of element 28. Okay? It just takes a little bit of exploration to see that we are already, you know, hinting at what they're, or touching upon what they're hinting at here. That even with, you know, all of the qualifications of the validity of our current model, we pick up on this fact that things start to get a little bit convoluted, you know, and what should be higher, well, maybe it's actually lower now, and, you know, and things start to, you know, get muddled together, and we have a hard time understanding it right at 28. The fact that when you look at how convoluted some of our rationalization schemes get for the complicated atoms, I mean, you can't put all the fault on these silly initial assumptions that we're running with right now. It's just plain complicated. Yeah. You know, it's like the evolution of humans. You know, we have all kinds of simple assumptions that we make. But the revelators tell us a number of things, because we have no idea just how complicated it actually was. And you will never figure it out without their help. You know, you had 7,000 biologically compatible strains, you know, that the Andonites could backmate with. You know, science has no idea how complicated it is, right? You know, the same way here. I mean, there are so many internal complexities and environmental complexities that it's going to take some very advanced physics to even begin to sort it out. And obviously, see, even they have to deal with some things just empirically. They can't actually calculate all of the details from first principles. It's just too complicated. You can't take into account all of the subtleties of the supreme, say. Right. And that's why, you know, we're talking about base 10 and decimal here. That's why there are decimal worlds, right? Because of that unpredictability. The life carriers and others, you know, roughly every 10 worlds, have to loosen the constraints a bit and just let all of these inscrutable things that you can't calculate from first principles play out a little more definitively. Rather than being kind of down in the noise, you know, loosen the constraints, let them play out more definitively, so you can measure them. It's like, oh, that's where the supreme is right now. You know, about every 10 worlds, they have to test and see where the supreme is, so that they can keep in sync with the supreme. You know, they can't predict in advance the evolution of the supreme. Okay, so they have to test it about every 10 worlds. You know. And then, so, you know, for, you know, the next set, they know if they do it based upon that data from that test, they won't be in rebellion. They won't be in defiance of evolution. But, you know, after 10 worlds, they got to test it again because it's the supreme is moving on.
They didn't count on rebellion at all.
Okay. So, all right, so, see, all of this stuff of, you know, of life on the on this planet having a tenfoldness and all this tenfold. You notice how you just invariably start to talk about all these things at the same time, as they ended it there. You know that when all is said and done, personality and pattern are two different expressions of the same thing in very, very inscrutable ways. Okay, that even very high beings can only assess empirically. You can't calculate it from first principles. All right, let's take a moment here.